From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Foreign students at U.S. colleges, beware of dropping classes. You could be jailed and deported. The Supreme Court of Venezuela suspends a referendum on President Hugo Chavez. The government halts foreign currency trading, and supporters and opponents of Chavez plan major protests today, Venezuela's Independence Day. We'll go to Caracas. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has chosen a man who's characterized AIDS as the gay plague to serve on the Presidential Advisory Commission on HIV and AIDS. Pennsylvania marketing consultant Jerry Thacker has also described homosexuality as a death style and asserted that, quote, Christ can rescue the homosexual. He's a graduate and former employee of Bob Jones University. The Washington Post reports Thacker made these comments on various web pages that were recently removed from the internet. Thacker has also said homosexuality can be modified through religious faith. This is an approach that professional organizations say has no medical or scientific basis. Commission co-chair Tom Coburn said Thacker's views on homosexuality were irrelevant to the commission's efforts to stop AIDS. Thacker has also aggressively lobbied for abstinence until marriage education. He became involved in the AIDS issue in the mid-1980s when he says he contracted the AIDS virus after his wife was infected through a blood transfusion. He is expected to be appointed next week. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting the Bush administration plans to allow religious groups for the first time to use federal housing money to build religious centers where worship is held, as long as part of the building is also used for social services. The Bush administration told tens of thousands of abortion protesters in Washington, D.C. yesterday that they share their commitment, quote, to protect the lives of innocent children waiting to be born. President Bush spoke himself. He also asserted in his telephone call to the protests that the anti-abortion movement is gaining steam in Congress and that he expects Congress to pass a ban this year on the late-term medical procedure critics call partial birth abortion. On the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, abortion supporters also rallied in the nation's capital. The Federal Reserve reports the wealth gap between whites and people of color in the United States has rapidly increased. The median net worth for whites is now seven times that of people of color. In the last 3 years, the median net worth for whites increased by almost 20% to $120,000. Over the same period, it decreased 5% for people of color to $17,000. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration plans to demand that France, Germany, and other skeptics of military action against Iraq agree publicly that Iraq has defied the UN Security Council. The U.S. hopes these nations will realize their businesses might lose a possible role in exploiting Iraq's oil if they don't support the war. Meanwhile, in Paris, President Jean Chirac of France, President Jacques Chirac of France, and Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder of Germany met to proclaim their unity against war. This news from Venezuela. The Supreme Court has indefinitely postponed a nationwide referendum scheduled for next month on whether embattled President Hugo Chavez should resign. The ruling has stunned opposition leaders. The referendum would have been non-binding, but they'd hoped for a resounding defeat that it would increase political pressure on Chavez to step down. Also yesterday, the Venezuelan government closed the markets for 5 days, hoping to stem the exodus of capital and prevent its crippled currency from falling farther. And this from the BBC. President Bush is set to endorse using nuclear power to explore Mars and to open up the outer solar system. He's expected to back the NASA Nuclear Propulsion Initiative, Project Prometheus, either in his State of the Union address on Tuesday or later this year when he submits his 2004 budget to Congress. Anti-nuclear groups have warned that a launch failure of a nuclear-propelled rocket could lead to widespread contamination. This news from West Virginia. Three miners were killed and three more injured after a methane gas explosion in a coal mine air shaft on Wednesday. The injured had to be rescued from more than 900 feet below the surface. The third annual World Social Forum opens in Porto Alegre, Brazil today. Up to 100,000 people are expected to attend. On Friday, Brazil's new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, will become the first government leader ever to address the forum of activists and academics from around the world in person. Silva will then fly to Davos, Switzerland to participate in the World Economic Forum, which is also starting this week. Up to 2,000 business and government leaders are expected to meet in Davos, where opponents of corporate globalization are also expected to protest. And in Bolivia, the farmers' union has agreed to join a week-old blockade of major roads to support coca growers who are demanding an end to a U.S.-funded eradication campaign. If the blockade is successful, it will cut off the roads to the capital, La Paz, and other major cities around the country. At least six farmers have died and 50 others have been injured in violent clashes with police. And finally, West Coast dock workers and shipping companies approved a new contract yesterday, bringing an end to the dispute that closed major ports from San Diego to Seattle last year. The Seattle Times reports the International Longshore and Warehouse Union came out ahead on nearly every major point of contention in negotiations. Members voted an unprecedented 89% in favor of the six-year deal. The contract provides no-cost health insurance and a pay raise and a nearly 60% increase in pension benefits. Officials called it the biggest retirement gain in the history of the American labor movement. More importantly, the ILWU prevailed in its key demands regarding the introduction of new cargo tracking technology on the docks. No current members will lose jobs, and any new positions created by technology will fall under union jurisdiction. The Pacific Maritime Association won some concessions. Employers now will be able to operate new tracking systems that will allow more efficient movement of cargo containers off ships.
Abstraction in your head, reoccurring dread, toss and turn and bed, yeah. You think you've lost your mind. No, it's not that simple, though you wish it were. Count your victory. Add your misery, does it set you free? Yeah, 1,000 open doors, and you walk into a wall, don't it hurt at all? You may just get what you want, Kevin George, this is more than a test. Gotta know what you want. This is more than a test. It's your life.
Juan Avilar here on Democracy Now, live in our warehouse studio. You are listening to Democracy Now! Firehouse Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners out there and viewers on this cold, cold day in New York City.
We're talking
about 9 degrees, was it, this morning?
That it is. And make no mistake about it, even though the word warm is in global warming, this relates. Well, we're going to start off in a place that may even be colder today. It is Denver, Colorado. Last month, 25-year-old Yashar Zendidel sat off to the side of a jail cell away from the community toilet and the inmates at the Immigration Detention Center in Denver. His offense? Not completing enough college credit. The junior economics major from the University of Colorado at Boulder was one of at least six Middle Eastern college students studying in Colorado who were jailed in December for failing to take at least 12 hours of college credit. Today, as hundreds of thousands of college students are returning from winter break, we are going to take a look at what's happening with foreign students. We welcome you to Democracy Now! As we turn now to Denver, Colorado, to speak with Yashar Zendidel. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you just tell us your story? Talk about what happened when you decided to change your major.
Yeah, actually, I had 14 credit hours. It was last spring semester. And I decided to change my major after talking to many career counselors and advisors. And my advisor suggested I drop one course, which was a very tough computer course. And the international office told me that there is a law that if I get permission from school, I could go under 12 credit hours. So I did that, and the day I went for special registration in Denver, the agent didn't know about this law and took me into custody.
When you say the agent, where was the agent? I mean, were they actually at registration, or did you find out about this later?
No, he was actually in the INS office.
And how did they learn that you had dropped the course and gone below the...
Actually, I had my transcript with me, and it showed on transcript that I had 14 credit hours that semester, but one, I withdrew from one, so I earned 10 credits.
Now, you were registering at the INS because of the special registration, and you are from Iran?
Yes, it's Iran.
Mm-hmm. So when they said, you've dropped a course, so you've gone below the required credit hours, and you told them you had approval from the university, what did they do next?
Actually, he said that there is no such a law, and since I've gone under 12 credit hours, I've been out of status, and I had stayed illegal here, so he was going to put me through deportation process, and he took me into custody, put down a $5,000 bond, and he took me to jail.
This was finals week?
I'm sorry?
This was finals week?
Yeah, it was a week before the deadline, which was exactly a week before my finals.
Did you have any books with you to read?
No, I didn't.
So they arrested you right there on the spot and took you away?
Yes, right in there in the INS office.
And how long did you end up incarcerated?
About 40 hours from when I got arrested. I just stayed a night in there, but the whole bailing out process took a whole day.
Now, can you talk about that? The bond was set at $5,000. How did you raise that?
Actually, my friends came up with it. Three of my friends.
What would have happened if they didn't come up with it?
I would have stayed in there. I mean, he did not care that I was telling him that I had final exams next week, and I mean he couldn't hear me.
Now when you were incarcerated, what about some of the other people that were there with you? Were there many others who were also immigrant students among your group?
Actually, no, I didn't see any other students. Most of them were they were they had criminal background. They were already been in jail, in county jail. They had already done. They were already done with their time in jail for theft, for drug dealing, and they were taken to the INS jail to be deported. Mm-hmm. And they were all happy to be there because, you know, they had done their time, and they were going to go home.
Huh. Did you ask the INS official if you could, if he would call the school, since you had gotten approval for your course change.
Yes, I did, but I wasn't allowed to.
Were you allowed to make calls?
I wasn't. No, there was a telephone in the room. I wish I could make collect calls, but my friends went to my roommate actually went to school to the international office, and the international director kept calling the INS about this, but they never called him back.
At this point, what is your status? You got out of jail, you studied for your exams and took them. What's happening to you now?
Actually, international office finally got in touch with the INS, and they said, you know, it shouldn't have happened, it shouldn't have happened, and they said they were going to reverse the whole action. They just wanted me to finish my final exams and give them my new transcript, and then they were going to reverse it, which happened about 2 weeks ago.
And did you get the $5,000 back?
No, they said that's a several weeks process.
Mm-hmm. So are you on a deportation track now or not?
No, it's been reversed. They gave me back my passport and all my documents, just my money now.
I'm looking at a piece in the Daily Camera that describes what happened to you, and it quotes Larry Bell, the director of International Student Scholar Services at CU, at Colorado University. He says, if someone came in voluntarily, talking about going to the INS, well before the deadline, who didn't bring in the right papers, wouldn't you let them go back and get them? And he did say that you were legally designated by immigration officials under immigration law to have a reduced course load, that they had approved the course reduction for you at the university.
Yes, I didn't have that permission with me from school, but he didn't let me go get that permission. It was in my file in school. And I even told him I would leave my credit card, my ID, my passport, anything he needed.
Could you tell me what is the atmosphere these days among international students at the University of Colorado, the ones that you come in contact with, given this this amazing crackdown that's been occurring on foreign students generally?
Yes, actually, all my friends that study at CU, not all of them are international students, but all the people that I know, they were so mad about this, and they could not believe it, that this had happened to me. I mean, they said even if this wasn't a law, they shouldn't have taken you to jail for taking you know, 2 credits less than what you are supposed to.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. When we come back from a break, we're going to go to Johns Hopkins, to the head of International Services at Johns Hopkins Medical School. She gave a briefing to professors this week. I heard it, one dean said, we are back to the Palmer raids and the McCarthy era. And we're going to talk about a computer program that's going into place next week. About 1,000 or 2,000 universities are now in compliance, which, as the international students' information is put into the database through this program, it is also going directly to the Department of State, to the INS, to the Department of Education. Ports of entry information also goes into this database. Even a typo could send a student to jail. You're listening to Democracy Now! We want to thank you very much for joining us. We have been joined from Denver, Colorado, by Yasher Zendadel. Thank you very much. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Watching history turn while your future burns, Don't you ever learn, yeah, that Rome wasn't built on cliches. And neither was love, though you wish it were that way. Someday they'll rent the sun, auction off the sea, even tax the wind, yeah, the world is in your hands. Don't let her walk away, you know you need her love. You may just get what you want. Careful now, careful what you request. You gotta know what you want. This is more than a test. It's your life. You gotta know, you gotta know. It's your life.
That is Juan Avilar with Barry Lynn Stanley in our Firehouse studio. Very cold today, below 10 degrees in New York City. I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! Here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, Juan, students, international students, are facing very, very difficult times. Again, I was just speaking to a professor at Johns Hopkins University who went through this training this week with the head of international services. And said that while the decrees outside may be cold, it's even colder in the hallowed halls of the nation's universities. They were warned that even a typo that you put in around a student, whether a course change or a change of address or a spelling of a name, could lead to a student being picked up in jail. The stakes are very high. And we're going to talk about that right now.
Well, under SEVIS, which is the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System that the INS will be implementing, all colleges, universities, and graduate programs which receive federal funding will be required to transmit electronically detailed information on every international student directly to the INS, the State Department, and the Department of Education. Schools will transmit grades, course loads, majors, addresses, and any changes in this information. And if the schools fail to do so, they will lose federal funding. USA Today reports that up to 1,000 schools will not be ready by the January 30th deadline, and the INS will force these schools to suspend international student registration.
That's right. And today, just before the program, I reached Murray Welch, director of the Office of International Services at Johns Hopkins Medical School. She is giving the training to administrators and to professors, talking about how high the stakes are in dealing with international students. Even an address change, if a student moves across the street, if it's not reported to the INS and reported within the given time period, a student could be picked up. I just asked her to talk about her concerns about the newly instituted, just about to be instituted, computer program called Student Exchange Visitor Information System, or SEVIS, and just the overall atmosphere for international students. This is Murray Welch.
Well, I think the largest concern that every institution of higher education is struggling with right now is the amount of communication and constant follow-up that needs to happen with our international population and our international students and scholars that are here in FNJ status. Every school that admits international students has always maintained files on these students. I mean, it's always been a requirement. However, students always have classes, they have priorities, they have other things that take their attention away, just like when you and I were in school. And sometimes they can forget, and sometimes departments advise individuals to do things that may not be within the scope of immigration law, i.e. drop a class, that sort of thing. And so I think the largest concern we have is the amount of follow-up and the amount of communication that needs to happen continually with our faculty, with our administrators, and with our students, so that our records are updated before changes happen, before a student changes a class or changes a major or changes their course load. Those types of things.
We just heard the incredible story of a student in Colorado who dared to change his major from computer science to economics with his advisors recommending he drop a class. He then went to voluntarily register at the INS. He is from Iran, and they arrested him. Can you talk about the stakes and also what it means for students what are the things they should watch out for the most? For example, change of address, what that could mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the largest state, I guess, I would see our international population in right now is there's a large amount of concern and a degree of anxiety about making sure that their records are updated. Our experience here in Baltimore, Maryland, has been actually very good. The international or the immigration service here, I'm getting emails back from individuals that are going down for special registration. I got one yesterday that said, I went down to special register. The INS officers were very courteous. It went on without a problem. We haven't had any students who have run into any difficulties like the particular case you just cited. It is a concern, though, if a student does change his or her major, does drop below a full course of study, and fails to get authorization or approval before that happens, then they have technically fallen out of status in some way with the new regulations. So that causes, I think, any student a degree of anxiety.
And could be arrested.
Well, I don't know that. I can't say that. I haven't seen that situation here. Obviously, it happened in this other case that you talked about. Whether or not that's widespread or not in terms of practice, I can't really comment on. I have not seen it here, but that's not to say it can't happen. So my level of advice to all of our international scholars and students and all of the updates that we're giving our scholars and students is don't change anything in your degree program. Do not drop a class. Do not change your major. Do not change your department without coming to see us first, so that we can be sure, extra sure, that everything is okay, that there won't be any issues that you could run into should immigration have a question about your activities here in the United States. We want to keep our students as safe as possible.
In this computer program that is now linking every administration office that deals with foreign students to the State Department, to the Education Department, to the INS, to ports of entry around the country, what is the price of even the smallest mistake, a typo?
That's difficult to say because we haven't, I don't think any school has used CVIS or SEVIS like 24/7 yet. Some schools are still waiting for authorization, as you said in your beginning or your introductory remarks. At Johns Hopkins, we have been on CVIS for issuing documents for international students who are here in F status, but we have not yet been approved to bring individuals in on J status.
And F status, J status is?
F status is individuals who are pursuing a degree program in the United States, normally with personal funds or funds from a university. And the J program is an exchange visitor program, individuals who are participating in the Department of State run program where there's various exchange activities that happen between countries and they can come to research or study and do a variety of activities. So, you know, whereas I've been involved in the I-20F issuance side for CVIS, I have not yet had experience on the J side. However, one thing I can tell you is that the system is a database system. It is, and databases are inherently written to have rules and certain things that you can and cannot do in a database. Traditionally in the past, you know, if there was a mistake in a file or if there was a typo or if there's something happened, we would do a paper fix. We would simply amend the documents and do a sort of paper fix for the file and life was good. I think there's a large degree of anxiety between those of us who are international educators who didn't major in typing, that, you know, we could make a typo. And there are ways to fix mistakes in CVIS, but they're not necessarily the easiest. Sometimes you have to call a 1-800 number to have a record fixed, and you may need to stay online or stay on the phone and wait for an immigration assistance officer on the other side to help you figure out how to fix a particular problem.
Murray Welsh, as you all comply with this program that links you directly to the government with student information, has there been any lobbying of the Justice Department of, say, John Ashcroft to loosen these rules, to change these rules altogether rather than just comply?
I think the institutions of higher education as a whole and our various national associations try and strike a balance between supporting Homeland Security, because obviously that is a priority, and nobody wants to see another September 11th happen. And I think the public as a whole and people who work in higher education as a whole understand that that's a real concern. So on one side of the fence, we want to be supportive of that and do what we can to help our, I guess, our immigration colleagues or our Department of State colleagues that have to kind of come to terms with this legislation. At the same point, I think many people are now realizing that some of the legislation that was passed was somewhat reactionary to September 11th. And so there has been discussions with Congress on the Hill about sort of coming to terms with how realistic this system is and what sort of additional burden it places on schools.
That is Murray Welsh, Director of the Office of International Services at Johns Hopkins Medical School. As she said yesterday, it used to be that the students were just innocent. Now they have to prove they're innocent, and that can be a little tough at times. We're joined on the telephone from Boston now by Greg Leonard. He basically occupied the same position as Murray Welsh at Boston University, head of International Student Services, but is now vice president for Newfront Software, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Newfront has been developing the software that will be used in the SEVIS system, SEVIS again standing for Student and Exchange Visitor Information System, that more than 1,000 universities are putting into effect next week, that will track international students and link them directly to the Department of Education, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the Department of State. Also tied to the INS SEVIS system are ports of entry around the country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Greg Leonard.
Good morning. Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us more about the student tracking programs that are now being mandated at universities?
Well, it's basically pushing data to an Immigration and Service Naturalization, Immigration and Naturalization Service database that all schools had been sending to the Immigration Service for decades in paper form, and the Immigration Service simply was not able to deal with the paper. Their records historically have been notoriously incomplete and inaccurate. And what the Student Exchange Visitor Information System is doing is simply bringing this particular aspect of the Immigration Service's work, the aspect with international students, professors, and researchers, into the electronic age by using technology, computers, and pushing data through the Internet to the Immigration Services database.
Now, will this system not merely be certifying that students are taking proper course loads, but will it also be transmitting information like the courses that they are taking and other vital information about them?
No, there is no requirement at the current time to transmit course information. The Immigration Service will know every school term whether a student is registered or not, and whether the student is a full-time student, which they are required to be by immigration regulations under most circumstances, or whether they are a part-time student, have dropped below a full course of study. So not only will simple factual information be sent, but also some of this information could have a negative effect on a student, as you've been discussing earlier in the program.
Can you talk about your concerns about that, where you have a student who drops a class, which is a major, is advised by the university to perhaps drop a class, can be picked up and jailed?
That's really an extreme occurrence, in my opinion. I believe that, and I believe this I'm very correct on this observation, that occurred because of the special registration requirements that apply to certain nationalities in the United States right now. It did not happen simply because this person was an international student. There are many international students throughout the United States that drop below a full course of study and do not realize that's a violation of the immigration regulations. And when the advisors, the international advisors at schools, find out about that, they work with the student to get them reinstated to a lawful immigration status. So what happened with this particular student, I think, was really a result of the person having to go through special registration requirements. There's no question, though, that dropping below a full course of study is one of the primary concerns of international educators throughout the U.S., because reporting that type of information to the Immigration Service means that the data system that the INS maintains will probably automatically indicate that this person has violated a term or condition of lawful status. And if the person tried to travel outside the United States and come back in, or came into contact with the Immigration Service in some other way, the person could be detained, and there could be problems. This is not normally the type of thing that someone would be detained for a long period of time or actually arrested over. It's the type of thing that is dealt with, every week by a few people here in the United States.
Although in this student's case in Denver, he was on the process of being deported if his friends hadn't raised the $5,000 bail. But let me ask you about other issues like incompletes, getting a bad grade that might fail you, not reporting a change of address, even from one dorm room to another.
A change of address is something that is what most people would consider to be a minor violation. If it is not reported, it's the type of thing that could be reported late. I think schools are going to do a much better job now of monitoring changes of address and educating their students and scholars about letting them know when there is a change of address. It would only be if an individual fits a certain profile that is of concern to the federal government, that the government would even follow up on or perhaps even learn of a failure to report a change of address.
Well, when you say a specific profile, could you tell us a little bit, for instance, what's the universe that we're dealing with here? How many foreign students are there in the country that would fall under this system? And also whether the system denotes certain profiles that are looked at more specifically than others, let's say Middle Eastern students rather than Chinese students or anything like that?
The actual data system does not distinguish or treat individual records differently. All information that is sent in, that's required to be sent in, is sent on every international student, regardless of their nationality or citizenship. So there is no difference in the way the data or the requirements that the Immigration Service has established. What the Immigration Service is going to do with that data is something they have not talked about, nor will they talk about, I suspect. But I think everyone knows that they are operating basically looking for possible security risk, possible contacts they could make to get additional information that they might find useful in ongoing investigations that they have that are underway right now.
And yet we hear that administrators are very concerned, and the more they raise issues with the Justice Department, the more John Ashcroft makes these rules more stringent.
Yes, I think we're definitely into an environment these days where things are becoming much tighter, much more stringent, more requirements. It's clearly a time when universities and international educators and international students and scholars themselves need to be paying a lot closer attention to what is going on in their individual situations and making certain that the data that is going to the Immigration Service is accurate and is timely.
Could you tell me again what the universe of how many students would fall under this system? And also, in places like New York and Los Angeles and other major cities, there are quite a few permanent residents who are not U.S. citizens but are going to colleges and universities. It would not affect them, would it? Would just be someone who's here on a student visa?
That is correct. I could not tell you the exact number of international students, but it's a few hundred thousand who are here in the United States.
And is it just colleges, or are we talking high school too?
We're talking about high schools, secondary schools, colleges, and universities. The regulations apply to schools who enroll any one of three types of non-immigrants in the United States. One would be F1 students in academic degree programs. A second would be M1 students in vocational or training schools, including flight schools. And the third would be J1 exchange visitors. And the majority of J1 exchange visitors in the United States are international students, professors, and research scholars.
Well, I'll say it's quite a way to learn that you perhaps did not pass a test. You go out to visit your parents for the holidays. You come back in, and at the port of entry, they put your name in. They say, you failed your math course. We are taking you in, and you could possibly be deported.
Well, that would not happen if a student just failed a course and was not suspended from school, but if failing that course resulted in the student being suspended from school, then yes, that is a possible scenario to happen.
Hmm. Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Greg Leonard, Vice President for New Front Software, based in Cambridge. New Front has been developing the software that will be used in this student tracking system going into effect next week that will affect hundreds of thousands of students in this country, Student and Exchange Visitor Information System, known as SEVIS. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Caracas. There are major protests planned for today. We'll be speaking with Free Speech Radio News' Deepa Fernandez and also a representative of the Carter Center. Former President Jimmy Carter has come up with a plan. Stay with us.
Cuando la tarde languide, serenaste la sombra de la que tú los cafetales vuelven a sentir. Esa triste canción de amor de la abeja molenda, el letargo de la noche parece decir. Una pena de amor, una tristeza, lleva el San Samuel en su amargura. Paso el resto de la noche moliendo café.
¡Eso! ¡Que viva Venezuela! ¡Ese presidente Chávez!
¡Mamá, mamá, 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 mamá! ¡Moliendo café! ¡Moliendo café! ¡Moliendo café, café, café! ¡Moliendo café! ¡Moliendo café!
Juan Avilar and Barry Lynn Stanley, and you can get more information on their music at www.juan.ws. That's JUAN.ws. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And we move to Venezuela now. The Supreme Court of Venezuela yesterday indefinitely postponed a nationwide referendum scheduled for next month on whether embattled President Hugo Chavez should resign. The ruling has stunned opposition leaders. The referendum would have been non-binding, but they had hoped the resounding defeat for Chavez would increase political pressure for him to step down. Also yesterday, the government closed the financial markets for 5 days, hoping to stem the exodus of capital and prevent its crippled currency from falling further. U.S. multinational corporations, including Microsoft and Ford, have begun to close local offices and pull people out of the country.
Protests both for and against Chavez continue. On Monday, one person died and more than 20 were injured in protests. More protests are scheduled for today, an especially important day for Venezuelans. On January 23, 1958, a popular uprising backed by the military forced the dictator General Perez Jimenez to flee the country. Since then, the day has been celebrated almost like Independence Day is celebrated here in the United States. We go now to Deepa Fernandez, who is in Venezuela. She is the anchor of Free Speech Radio News. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Deepa.
Thank you, Amy. Good morning, Amy and Juan.
It's great to have you with us. Can you tell us where you are right now?
Right now, I am in the middle of a march. I've actually walked in because it's so noisy. There's so much going on out there in the streets. It's very hard to hear, but We are in the middle of a march in Caracas in an area called El Valle. It's a suburb. It's a low-income area, which has it's a strong base of support for President Chavez. And as you mentioned in your introduction, today, January 23rd, it's a very, very important day for Venezuelans. They think of it somewhat as the day that Venezuelan democracy was born. They liken the dictator Pérez Jiménez to Pinochet. And as you mentioned, today is the day in 1958 that Pérez Jiménez was overthrown. And so many, many, many people over the last 45 years have celebrated this day. Of course, this year it has a whole new meaning because the opposition forces have taken to likening President Chavez to the dictator Pérez Jiménez. So it's been a very interesting period leading up to the marches because the opposition has been warning people not to come out. They've even gone as far as predicting things like 900 deaths, that Chavez will send his militias out and there will be deaths in the streets, so not to go out. Everything I've seen so far, it's a very jubilant mood. People are celebrating. They're asking that the Constitution be respected. And as you also mentioned, the Supreme Court decision late last night, actually, to postpone the February referendum indefinitely. That's what Venezuelans who support Chavez call respecting the Constitution.
What's been the reaction in the commercial media to the Supreme Court decision?
Well, unfortunately, the media here, as I think many people know, is very, very concentrated. It's not actually a source of information by any means. You have 95% of the media controlled by few wealthy interests, one being Gustavo Cisneros, who, when Jimmy Carter came to Venezuela, he went fishing with him and then 2 days later met with President Chavez. So it'll be interesting to hear more about that meeting. But the reaction in the media has very much been that, of course, this is just further proof that there is no democracy in Venezuela, that Chavez is a dictator, that Chavez must resign, we must overthrow, we must do what the Venezuelan people did back in 1958 and overthrow the evil dictator. So it's a lot of rhetoric and as a lot of the pro-Chavez supporters will tell you, straight up lies.
I wanted to turn to a commercial that is being aired in the commercial media. No ads for laundry detergent or breakfast cereal on Venezuelan private TV channels. Just one attack ad after another, blaming Chavez for the country's ills. Let's roll one of those commercials right now.
Mr. President, you who have come through 5 elections in 2 years, why are you scared of measuring your support once again? You are to blame for the gas shortage. You are to blame for the food supply crisis. You are the only one responsible. You are the only one who can resolve this situation. Mr. President, elections now.
Now, those ads, Deepa, are sponsored by the media networks?
Yeah, exactly as you mentioned, Amy. It's a very interesting, fascinating thing to turn on television and not see any of the usual, soap ads or, like you said, breakfast cereal ads coming at you. There's none of that. It's commercial after commercial, slamming the government and telling people that they need to come out into the streets to ensure that Chavez resigns or that there are elections. And a very interesting thing happened on Monday, and I was in another place. It's actually further up north. It's on the coast. It's called Puerto La Cruz, and it's an oil town. And we were there doing some oil investigations, and we walked into just a shop just to get a bottle of water, and there was many, many people all watching a television screen, all yelling and screaming at the television screen. And we said, what's happening? What's going on? And they turned to us, all of them, and as soon as they realized we were foreigners, they started saying, see, this is what Chavez has done. Chavez has shut down the media. He just wants to censor everything. These two channels, what was actually happening was that the government was sanctioning 2 television stations for breaking the law, and they're laws that have existed for 40 years. And so Chavez is invoking laws that say, well, on the one hand, you cannot put on to the air propaganda that, as they call it, war propaganda, or propaganda that incites public disorder or chaos. That's breaking the law. Now, this law has existed for 40 years. No other president's ever invoked it, but Chavez has done that now, and that's what his people when we walked into this shop, the television stations were running it live, and they were reporting that they were being shut down, which was not true at all. They were being sanctioned. They have 2 weeks to respond to the claims that they've broken the law. But that was, to me, a really good example, and the hysteria that was whipped up around the place. Everybody was talking about it, and of course I was like, oh my gosh, we should cover this, we should do something about it. And the first phone call I made was to somebody, was to the head of Radio Nacional de Venezuela, which is the state-run radio. The first thing she said to me was, nothing's happened. They've just sanctioned them. This is how, you know, this is very, all they have to do is respond. So it's very hard to get information here because there is so, it's so polarized, and there's so much hysteria. And those exact kind of ads are the reasons why community media is growing so much here. I spoke to a woman yesterday who told me she does street theater, and she calls that a part of community media. And what they do is they go onto the little micro buses that run all around the streets of Caracas, and they start discussions with people. And it's exactly what that ad was saying. Chavez is responsible for the oil queues. Chavez is responsible for this and that. Chavez must resign. So they go onto buses and they start discussions with people because it's the only way of informing people that, no, maybe Chavez is not responsible for this. Let's talk about who started the shutdown of the oil industry.
We're talking to Deepa Fernandez in Caracas, anchor of Free Speech Radio News. Also joining us, Jennifer McCoy, director of the Americas Program at the Carter Center, also professor of political science at Georgia State University in Atlanta. She has just returned from Venezuela, where she was part of former President Carter's delegation to Venezuela to meet with President Chavez and opposition leaders. Jennifer McCoy, can you talk about what the meeting in Venezuela was like with each side and what former President Carter has now proposed?
Yes, we went as part of an ongoing effort that we've been involved in actually since last July, trying to bring the two sides together to talk and to resolve their differences peacefully. The talks actually began in November under the auspices of the OAS Secretary General Gaviria, and we've been supporting those talks. But as Deidre had reported, the polarization is deep, and there's a lot of action in the streets because people were fearing that the talks were not producing a result. And so we were requested to prepare some proposals and to put some concrete ideas on the table for both sides to consider, and that was the purpose of this meeting. So it was part of our ongoing efforts, really, for the last few months. Now, what I would say is that I think that both sides do understand and fear the damage to the country, to the economy, to the people of this ongoing dispute. Certainly, all of us are extremely concerned about the violence and the potential for more violence. And so I do think that both sides are looking for a way to resolve this and do want a way to resolve this peacefully and according to the Constitution. And so the two proposals we put forward are based on the Constitution, constitutional mechanisms that the people could choose in a referendum to, one was to make a change in the term of office for the president, to shorten it. It had been extended in the last Constitution to 6 years. And this proposal was to shorten it to 4 years and to shorten the congressional term also to 4 years, and then to hold new elections under those new terms in which anybody could run. So President Chavez could run, others could run for president, and anybody could run for deputy. That was one of the proposals. The other was to go following the provision in the new Constitution of Venezuela, which I don't know exists anywhere else in the world, that the any governmental position, including the president, halfway through the term can be subjected to a recall by the people if 15% of the voters sign a petition that say they want to have a vote on whether that position, that person should resign halfway through their term, then it can go to a national referendum. And that is the second proposal, is to prepare for that at the first possible date, which would be August 19th of this year.
Well, I'd like to ask you, that provision for a possible referendum on the Chavez presidency has been in the Constitution now since it was formulated some years ago. Why does the opposition feel, in their discussions with former President Carter, that they can't wait until August for such a referendum?
Well, the opposition had been fearing that the weakening of the independence of the other institutions of government, the Supreme Court, the Attorney General, the Comptroller General, the electoral authorities, etc., and the policies of the government were going in the wrong direction for in their eyes, and that they were lacking the mechanisms of checks and balances and also to participate in decision making. And so they felt like waiting, this was going back to last year, that waiting until August of this year would be too late. There would be too much damage done. Those are the arguments that they have been making.
I'd like to ask you about the some of the things that Deepa raised about the role of the commercial media in Venezuela. From what you've been able to see in terms of the newspapers and the television broadcasts, whether the commercial media in Venezuela is playing an educational or a divisive role in this conflict?
Well, let me explain a little bit about that and comment on the comments made before by Dietra. One, certainly the media is politicized and is taking a political role. And one of the reasons for that is that after President Chavez was elected in 1998 and then re-elected in 2000, the opposition parties, the traditional parties, were pretty much devastated and fairly much wiped out. There was no political leadership on the opposition side, and any democracy needs a constructive opposition. And so without that, there was no, and this fed into the perception that there was absolutely no checks and balances on what the government was doing. And so filling in the gap were other actors in the society, including the media, the labor unions, the business confederation, the business chambers of commerce, and even the church.
Jennifer McCoy, because we're going to have to go in a minute, I think a lot of people are wondering about former President Carter's fishing trip with Gustavo Cisneros, who is known as George Bush Sr.'s fishing partner. What happened on that visit?
President Carter has told the Venezuelans that the Cisneros family is a longtime family friend of the Carter family. This was a private trip in which three of President Carter's close friends from the United States were invited to go. It was organized by Gustavo Cisneros. It was a private social gathering.
And I'm sure they talked about the issues, though.
As I understand, it was a social trip, and they did not discuss the negotiations.
Deepa Fernandez, last word. We only have about 30 seconds.
Well, people here on the streets, they're hoping that there will be some resolution to this crisis, too, and they're actually hoping that if ex-President Carter has another chance to meet with Cisneros, as they are close friends, that he will say to him that he needs to play a much stronger role, that he needs to stop his economic shutdown of many industries which his own television stations are calling for, which his media is calling for.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Deepa Fernandez in Caracas with Free Speech Radio News. Jennifer McCoy of the Carter Center just returned from Venezuela and Carter's trip. Well, that does it for the show. If you want to get a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, and email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!